I found simple, logical explanations for a lot of centuries-old stories and myths. By 6 a.m., I had developed an irresistible curiosity. I wanted to check out, firsthand, some of the things I just read about. Chapter 5, My Trip to Nazca Plains. I didn't have to show up at the office until 10 o'clock that morning, so I managed to get a few hours' sleep. Since I felt rested, I made up my mind to see those landing strips and ground drawings I just read about. As long as I was already in Peru, I decided the time to do it was now. I had a quick breakfast and headed directly to the office. Very little was happening. Everyone had Monday morning faces, even though it was Tuesday. Nancy was very apologetic about breaking our date the Thursday before. I told her cheerfully to forget it and assured her that I'd had a great time on the trip. I worked until about noon, then left and went to a travel agency located in our building. I wanted to find the best and fastest way to the Nazca Plains. The agent told me I would have to drive to the city of Pisco, where I would find an airport with small aircraft for hire. He recommended flying as the best way to get a good look at the ancient relics. I also learned I could drive to the Ingenio Valley by way of the Pan American Highway, which is the only coastal road running through the Nazca Plains drawings. That evening after work I drove to the city of Lee, about 180 miles south of Lima. Since the speed limits weren't enforced, it took me only 3 hours to get there. Lee was a very charming place. Even though located in a hot, dry desert, the town offered great weather, a lot of greenery, and the magnificent Hotel de Turistas, which is comparable to the finest hotels in the United States. Again I discovered it is a small world, when I ran into the mayor of the town, Alfredo Elias Vargas, whom I'd met about 3 weeks before at a horse show in Santa Rosa, California. We had even traveled in the same Braniff aircraft to Lima. When I mentioned the purpose of my visit to Mr. Elias, he called his brother, a pilot at the Pisco Airport. The two of them made arrangements for me to get a plane the following morning. Mr. Elias asked me to join him for a drink at the hotel and also invited me to his hacienda the next day to look at some of his horses. I accepted his invitation, excused myself, and immediately headed to my room to get some sleep. Even though I'd had an afternoon siesta, I was still feeling the effects of the long drive and lack of sleep the night before. I arrived, fresh and rested, at the Pisco Airport around 7 o'clock Wednesday morning. The sun was bright, a marvelous day for flying and exploring. The pilot arrived with two other men. They spoke in German and were not very friendly. The four of us strapped ourselves in our seats and took off. In a few minutes we were viewing a large fork-like figure on the side of a sandy cliff at the Pisco Bay. The figure had three main stems. The one in the center was longer than the other two. Spreading out from the long stems were smaller branch-like stems, all pointing in the same direction. It was about 3 to 4 city blocks in length. After flying about 45 minutes, we were able to see the Nazca Plains at a distance. We followed the direction indicated by the fork-like figure. The pilot was Peruvian, but had an excellent command of English. I wanted to ask questions, but it was difficult to hear over the noisy engine. I gathered that this was just a routine flight for the pilot. But for the rest of us, it was an exciting new experience. We flew at a high altitude for a while, getting in my trip to Nazca Plains overall picture of the markings of the Nazca lines, all going in different directions. As the plane descended, we circled the area. Everything I was seeing at this moment I had already seen in the Maria Reich book and in a few illustrations from Chariots of the Gods. The long strips just stopped, leading nowhere. It seemed reasonable to believe that they could have been used as landing airfields for some huge aircraft. I also saw perfectly drawn lines of animals, a monkey, a spider, birds, lizards and other creatures. The pilot asked me, in Spanish, to translate to the Germans that at this altitude, one could identify all the animal figures perfectly, but from the ground, the incisions in the earth were unidentifiable, appearing to be just lines in the sand. The pilot emphasized that whoever made those drawings meant them to be seen only from high above. The big question was, who? It was a temptation to blurt out the information I had recently heard from Rama, but decided against it. We were in the air for approximately 2.5 hours before heading back. We landed in Pisco about mid-morning. By noon, I was back in Lee to visit Mr. Alfredo Elias's estate, just outside the city. I was spending a wonderful couple of hours with Mr. Elias at his hacienda, viewing his horses and enjoying the smoothest riding I'd ever experienced. Then suddenly I remembered I had a job. I called the office from the ranch. Nancy told me not to worry, she was holding the fort. When I got back to Lima, I went to a few bookstores where they sell books in English and began looking for literature on flying saucers. I bought a copy of Eric von Daniken's Gods from Outer Space and John Fuller's Incident at Exeter. I reminded myself to keep an open mind as I read these books. I spent the next 3 days reading. Von Daniken's books were interesting, quite explicit, and convincing. Both books dealt with unexplained mysteries in recorded human history, linking them to visitors from other planets. Many questions are raised as a challenge to modern science. Because these books are well written in simple, layman's language, anyone with little more than an elementary education could understand them. They are fully researched and investigated and well documented. The authors have traveled to many continents in search of the evidence of ancient astronauts. I wished I'd had the opportunity to read one of these books before I had gone on my trip the previous weekend. My whole attitude would have been different, both about seeing UFOs for the first time and the information conveyed by Rama. I thought about Rama while reading them, because the authors quoted the Bible extensively, making comparisons between the holy scriptures and the ancient texts of Indian and Oriental cultures. It became very clear to me that the beliefs of various cultures are very similar, the differences being only a matter of language. I also discovered that von Daniken had gathered much of his information for his books in the territory where I was presently working. I decided to do a little first-hand research on the area myself. I asked Nancy, a native of Peru, to tell me about the ancient legends and myths of the ancient Peruvians. I was now convinced that Peru was a land where history and science could not come to a conclusive agreement on how the Nazca markings came to be or who had carved the stone-faced, brooding monoliths at Easter Island. This was not my first experience seeing these things. On two of my previous visits to Peru I'd had the opportunity to travel to Cuzco, Sacsayhuaman, Machu Picchu, the Titicaca Lake, Tiahuanaco, going as far as La Paz, Bolivia. At that time the tour guide told me that no one had been able to determine how these cities were built at such incredible altitudes without modern technology. I saw the underwater conduits, the Gate of the Sun, the Citadel of Machu Picchu, and now I was seeing the frosting on the cake, the Nazca Plains. Meeting Rama had intensified my interest in the mystery of these ancient relics. My studies reassured my radical mind. I was not quite as frightened as I had been about what had happened in the Andes Mountains. The more I read on the subject, the more I was able to accept some of the things Rama had told me. Incident at Andita, written by John G. Fuller, was a turning point for me. Fuller gave a completely detailed journalistic report on several UFO sightings in various parts of the United States. After reading this book, I was able to seriously consider the possibility that Rama could be an extraterrestrial. An intriguing part of Fuller's book dealt with the blackout that hit the northeastern part of the United States on November 9, 1965, leaving Boston, New York and New Jersey without power for over 7 hours. Fuller points out that this power failure is still unexplained and that some weeks before several people reported seeing UFOs, or strange objects, in the sky, on or near the ground, close to power lines. Fuller gave very plausible explanations to many questions I'd been asking myself since the blackout. On the first Friday of July, 1974, less than 2 weeks since I'd met Rama, I sat in my office, looking at my desk, piled high with all kinds of literature on Peruvian history and legend, scientific reports, magazine articles on UFOs in ancient times, and essays on Inca architecture. How could I continue to believe that all these reports of flying saucers were fiction? Especially now that I had become an eyewitness myself. But here I was, still skeptical about my friend from outer space. While I was becoming more receptive to the idea that she was some form of superintelligence from another world, I was still afraid to believe it. I wanted to know more, I was ashamed of my ignorance. I opened one of the drawers in my desk where I still kept the copy of the Dinua Post, dated Monday, June 24, 1974. Again I tried to find a reasonable explanation for its appearance in the remote region of the Andes Mountains the morning it was to hit the streets in Colorado. A jetliner takes between 6 and 11 hours to get to Lima, Peru, depending upon which city it departs from and how many stops it makes before it arrives. Then, from Lima, it would have had to travel another 6 hours to the place where we had been, by train or automobile. By train it would have taken 8 hours. I know some newspapers go to bed dated before they hit the streets, but this was one of the newsstand copies, a regular city edition. I knew my airline timetables by heart. The connection from Stapleton International Airport in Denver, Colorado to Jorge Chavez International in Lima was not that simple, even if I assumed the paper had hit the street at 5 in the afternoon the day before. It could never have made it to Huancayo by 12 noon the next day. I tried working it out in very possible way. I couldn't come up with any logical answer. To add to my confusion, I recalled that there was a 2-hour time difference. And I couldn't imagine anybody going that far out of their way to play a joke on someone. I knew I had to go back and see her again. The Peruvian general manager of our office was vacationing in Europe. Nancy and I were minding the store. As far as my work was concerned, everything was somewhat under control. This was my golden opportunity to return to the Andes Mountains. This time I was prepared. I made up my mind that my trip to Nazca Plains would fear nothing. I had read all the UFO reports I could get my hands on and never came across any evidence of physical harm to any witnesses. Besides, Rama didn't seem to be the kind of person with such intentions. I recalled her exotic, almost oriental, beauty. Her eyes, big, deep, and slanted, were enhanced by high cheekbones. The last time I had seen her I looked into those eyes. They revealed an almost childlike warmth and vulnerability. And her patience was almost beyond comprehension. Even when I insulted her, calling her a fake or accused her of putting me on, she remained sweet and kind. I decided to close shop early and head for the mountains. I even considered calling New York to request a permanent transfer to Lima. About mid-afternoon I drove Nancy home and asked her to take care of all the incoming calls from headquarters, just in case I didn't get back on time Monday morning. Then I stopped off at the Sheraton to pick up a few things, including my Bible, I had found one in English, and all of the books I had read. The drive up the mountains was nowhere as painful as my first trip, but still no joy ride, either. I took it slow and easy, not wanting to push myself or the rented car. I stopped to pick up a hitchhiker, who told me he was a mine worker on his way to La Olla, a big town in the Andes Mountains where all the minerals from Cerro de Pasco mines were sent for smelling. As we passed the UFO contact sign, the man mentioned that a policeman in Huancayo had some sort of contact with beings from outer space. He said he thought the man was as crazy as all the other people who still believed in flying saucers. When I arrived in Ocaya, the lady at the hotel fixed me a room and a good meal while I went down to the bathhouses. As it was extremely cold, I gathered some wood and built a fire, knowing I would be freezing when I got out of the water. I was right. I dressed in front of the fire, had my meal and went straight to bed. As soon as my head touched the pillow I fell into a deep sleep. I woke up a little past 9. The morning sunshine made the air seem crisp and fresh. I went down to the bathhouse and, as it was Saturday, a number of people were waiting a turn for the baths. I could have gone into the open swimming pool, but it was still a bit too cold for that. I waited in the warm sunshine, making an effort to be calm and relaxed. In spite of myself, my anxieties returned. Even though my studies had convinced me of the existence of UFOs, I was still uncomfortable with the idea. What if this were all a hoax? Maybe I had been right all along and Rama was working for the CIA, or she and her friends were up to something not quite kosher here in Peru. Or maybe she was just some smart aleck who wanted to have a good laugh at my expense. The only thing I knew for sure was that she always knew exactly what I was thinking. I had always thought that people who claimed to be clairvoyant, or have ESP, psychic or mind-reading abilities were phonies. Now I wasn't so sure. Just then, at a distance, I heard the sound of a powerful motorcycle. I turned to see Rama arriving on her LAPD Harley Davidson. I resolved that today I would demand some proof of her claim to be an alien being from outer space. "Hello, Rama," I said. "How are you?" She looked into my eyes for a moment before answering. "Salve," she said, which is Latin for hello. "What do you see?" she asked. "I like what I see. But I came here to straighten out some things. Charles, my friend, my brother," she said, "please save your words. I've been listening to you thinking. I know you have doubts. But my being here is not a hoax. I don't have time to play little games with you. So as far as proof is concerned, I told you before, that all depends on how fast you rid yourself of your doubts and fears." She was responding to my thoughts as if I had spoken them aloud to her. "Rama, you're utterly fantastic. You seem to know my thoughts almost before I think them." "No, not before you think them. Is there a simple, logical explanation for the way you appear to sense my thinking?" "Yes. You call it telepathy. It's a universal way of communicating. Brain waves are explosions of energy all around you. Remember the force we talked about the last time we were here?" "Vaguely, but I don't understand it." "Then we have to start at a level where you can make a picture in your mind what this force really is, and what it's called. Then you'll understand it. Later, you'll learn to control it." "Control it? How?" "Once you know and understand it, you can actually control it." "How long will it take me to learn that?" "It depends on how fast you can accept the fact that I'm really an extraterrestrial. Look, forget that I'm from another world for now. Let down your guard. Let's just pretend we're friends from different countries or cities. Isn't that the way you'd do it with any one of your girlfriends?" "Yeah, I guess so. But they don't pop into my life and say, 'Hi, I'm from another planet,' either. Anyway, if you have something for me to learn, tell me. I've been looking forward to this. I read some things and made some of my own investigations. I have a lot of questions." "That's terrific. It pleases me that you're here. I must be doing something right. You win yourself a cookie. I'll let you drive my police bike. About 5 minutes from here is another place we can bathe. It's close to the riverbank and to get in we have to go into a subterranean passage." "Great," I said, both pleased and apprehensive, as I had never driven a Harley Davidson before. I sat on the bike, fidgeting with its paraphernalia until I got the feel of it. Then we took off. Rama rode behind me, hugging my back. We drove for a while before I became confident enough with the bike to let my mind wander. I thought about all the questions I wanted to ask Rama about the von Daniken books. I'd marked passages I wanted to ask her about. I had even made indexes. I couldn't wait to talk to her about these books. Suddenly, while I was deep in thought, I heard Rama's voice inside my head. It was very clear, yet her voice was in my mind without using sound. In fact, it would have been impossible for us to even try to talk to each other, as at that moment our eardrums were being assaulted with the sound of a powerful precision-made machine echoing against the mountains and canyons at full speed. I accepted it. without trying to understand what was happening. I returned my thoughts to her the same way. I recall the dialogue we had in direct mind-to-mind conversation. It started with Rama saying, "I can see you were a good boy and did a lot of reading." "Yes, I did," I answered. "What we are doing now," she explained, "is an old way of getting the point across without speech. We are now at such a proximity with each other that it makes this telepathic conversation a lot easier. I know you're getting my thought waves and understanding perfectly. Mental communication is faster and more accurate. You're coming through loud and clear. It's sort of weird, but it's difficult to fight it. There's no logical explanation of how this is happening. There's nothing weird about it, Charles. Lots of people here have mastered this telepathic ability. As I told you the other day, there's nothing strange about it. It's new for you, but as soon as you accept it and understand it logically, you'll have no problems communicating the same way with me and those who have reached the point of using it wisely. Will I, Rama? You're doing it now, aren't you? It could still be a trick. I'm sure that some people here on your planet would call it a trick, a miracle, supernatural, from the world beyond, and for a scientific mind like yours it would be a little difficult to accept. But be patient. You'll see how well we're going to get along. Is this part of the force you keep talking about? Yes, by all means. Rama, I have all kinds of questions about UFOs. The first thing I want to know is about the power blackout we had in November, 1965, in the northeastern part of the United States. Did you have anything to do with it? Not me personally, but us, yes. It was a strategy, sort of a test. I'll tell you more about it when I talk about our activities in this world. We thought something like that would be the best and quickest way to get your interest. When that happened, I was in New York. I followed all the news coverage. I had a very special interest in it because at the time I thought it might be a communistic sabotage, or a conspiracy to take over the country. Even months later, when everyone seemed to have forgotten about it, including the ones who were investigating it, I was still intrigued by this mysterious event. Once in a while I'd think about it and wonder what could cause a power failure of such magnitude. Nothing was broken, very few people were hurt, yet no one seemed capable of finding or repairing the damage. No one ever came up with a sensible explanation for the failure, either. The lights just came back on 7 hours later. You say it was some kind of test? Yes, a strategy, an experiment, just as you are. I'm an experiment? You said that once before. Just what exactly do you mean? The time has come, we find it necessary to establish contact with a number of people on this green, water planet. You're the kind of person we like to talk to. I'll level with you. First, I'll share my knowledge with you, including how to handle the third force. That's imperative before we can go any further. Then you'll be able to read minds as well as we're carrying on this mental conversation at this moment. You've got to be kidding, Rama. No, I'm not kidding. I'm just being cautious. Remember, Rama, I'm only a lowly earthly and my mind doesn't function as quickly nor as well as yours. Do you believe me now? You're reading my mind and you know I can't help it. But I'm still doubtful about your being from another world. Why do you find that so impossible to believe? It's just too staggering to my mind and imagination. Maybe if you keep talking to me like this and making sense as you've been doing, you'll convince me. All right, I'll do just that. But you have to promise me that you'll keep an open and objective mind, and that my trip to Nazca Plains you'll refrain from spoiling things with your ugly thoughts. Agreed? Agreed. The Fatima message is the word of goodwill delivered from someone who appeared to three shepherd children by someone who was supposed to be the mother of Jesus Christ, correct? That's what I've read. Well, in reading the von Daniken books, didn't you constantly come across the same old plot of apostrophe gonines coming from heaven in their chariots of fire? Didn't they usually communicate with earthlings before great disasters such as the Great Flood and the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah? haven't you read accounts of them helping people, mingling with them, founding nations and countless other activities? These people descend upon the earth to teach, and the special individuals lucky enough to receive their instruction write about their experiences. From the little I've read, it seems most of these authors are people who are troubled and searching for some specific answer to philosophical questions about God, humanity, justice, slavery, things of that nature. We choose the people that we reveal ourselves to very, very carefully, because what we offer primarily is wisdom and eternal life. Eternal life? Are you saying that if I'm a good boy, as you put it, I'll get to live forever? These are the only really special things I have to offer you. Wisdom and eternal life. You're putting me on again, Rama. I could say some very nasty things, but since you're allegedly a creature from another planet, I won't be quite so vulgar. You see, my suspicious little brother, how you try to spoil this beautiful thing. Here I am, offering you a way to achieve eternal life, and you're thinking of obscenities. I keep thinking you're just someone from this planet who is trying and succeeding in making fun of me. I may accept that you do possess some very extraordinary powers, such as the ability to read minds, and that you're quite astute, clever, very beautiful, and sweet as sugar, but when it comes to being from another planet, with all due respect to your fantastic abilities, I have to tell you there are times when I think you are constipated. I take it that's your way of saying I'm full of it. I guess mind-to-mind communication conveys semantics very well. Charles, all I have to say for now is that I will be patient with you. I'm certain you'll come around when you're good and ready. Rama, can you imagine what my people back in New York would say if I told them I'd met a creature from another planet? If your people have an open mind, they would at least give it some consideration. They might also be able to achieve eternal life. For a while we rode in complete silence. I went deeper into my thoughts. With every turn and bump on the road, I could feel Rama's little body tenderly snuggle against me, hugging me reassuringly. I began to feel guilty for having been such a bastard to her. She was very sweet and gentle and didn't deserve that kind of treatment, yet I couldn't get over the feeling that she was still putting me on. We drove to the end of one of the canyons. A huge stone chimney loomed like a warning sign, indicating we would soon be in the vicinity of toll booths and the Peruvian road patrols. I downshifted, made a turn and headed back in the direction of Akaya. Rama never uttered a sound, but I sensed her approval. Again we drove in silence, mentally and otherwise, for almost an hour. By now the noon sunshine was hot and strong. We both felt the need for a break. 3 miles before the city limits of Akaya, slightly off the main road, a bridge led to the old central highway on the opposite side of the Mantaro River. Not far from the bridge was an old house, almost in ruins. We parked the bike and walked about 100 feet further to a subterranean passage that led directly into an underground cave where the water emerged in warm springs, bubbling up from beneath the river. It was a beautiful natural spa where the clean, clear water appeared to actually boil because of the intense carbonation. As we reached the water's edge, I said to Rama, "I feel badly about the things I said. But this whole thing is so unbelievable, I guess I got kind of hostile. Forgive me for saying those things I did when we were on the bike. The one consolation is you've provided me with a good start towards mental communication." "Don't feel too bad, Chicho," she said gently. "I know how you feel. I'd like you to do something for me. Go into the water for a couple of minutes. Dig deeply into your thoughts. What I'm about to tell you requires a lot of recalling." As we prepared to get into the water, Rama said, "Throughout your schooling, you must have had some pretty fantastic teachers whom you could hardly wait to see in your next class. I can name a few without going into any deep recollection: Richard Smith, Psychology 305, University of Northbridge, California; Carmelo Gariano, Carlos Blanco Gonzalez, Iris Shah, my swimming and diving instructor. I guess there are more, if I really give it some thought. What's the point? Would you have insulted Iris Shah by telling her she was a phony? Or would you have told Richard Smith you thought he was neurotic?